the overall question that I would like to pose this morning, before we get into more specific questions, is what is the message of Purim for us today, for our lives? And perhaps just as important is the second part of the question, how can we take the message of Purim and inculcate it into our lives and grow from this Purim and become better, deeper people as a result of this holiday? Having understood that this is our megama, this is our goal for the morning, I'd like to raise two very general questions about the holiday of Purim, and then two more specific questions about this holiday. And I think by trying to understand the answers to these questions, we'll come up with an approach and a deeper understanding of what Purim is all about. There's a very strange statement of the Arizal, and this is in source number one, when he explains that the sanctity of Yom Kippurim, the Day of Atonement, is of a lesser degree than that of Purim. Reading Kippurim as like Purim, surely there's no greater contrast between these 2 days. Says the Arizal the following: we have perhaps the most solemn and the most holy day in the Jewish calendar is a day called Yom Kippurim, the Day of Atonement. And if one takes a look at the name Yom Kippur, Yom HaKippurim means the day, Yom. Kippurim, the Kaf, is the Kaf Atima Yom, which is like Purim. That Yom Kippur resembles Purim, and explains the Ari, the fact that Yom Kippur resembles Purim, Purim is of a higher level than Yom Kippur. What does that mean? Can we imagine, as Rav Dessler states in source number, the end of source one, can we imagine 2 days which are so dissimilar in the way we celebrate these days? Yom Kippur is a day of fasting, a day of prayer, a day of repentance, and Purim is a day of joy, a day of celebration, a day of partying, a day of drinking. Can we compare the two and then yet say that Yom Kippur is of a lesser degree than Purim? What does that mean? Our second general question really is a spin-off of the first. The holiday of Purim, the way we celebrate it with all this joy and the drinking and the dressing up, seems so uncharacteristic of the way we celebrate in Judaism. Even a yontif, even a holiday, when there's a mitzvah of simcha, there's a commandment to be happy, and we eat meat and drink wine, it's still half to God and half to ourselves. Half the day in shul and in learning, and half the day feeding our physical selves and physical enjoyment. But you can't compare even the simcha of a yontif at first glance to Purim. Purim just seems to be off the map in terms of the amount of joy and celebration that's found. What does this all mean? Why is it that we have such a day of joy? Those are the two general questions. How is Purim and Yom Kippur similar? And how do we understand the way we celebrate this joy? Then two specific questions. There's a famous verse at the end of the Megillah, at the end of the story. It's a verse that we recite out loud every Havdalah ceremony, at the end of every Shabbat, at the conclusion of Shabbat. LaYehudim haita ora v'simcha v'sasa v'ikar. In source number two, the translation, the Jews enjoyed light and joy, gladness and glory. It was a happy time. To which our rabbis note the following. Our rabbis explain that each one of these aspects, light, joy, gladness, and glory, aren't they really the same thing? Why are we stating each one specifically? So our rabbis explain in the Talmud and Megillah that each one of these different adjectives represent a different aspect of Judaism. Light means Torah, joy means festival, gladness means circumcision, and glory means tefillin. And as Rashi on the page in the Talmud explains, there was obviously some type of decree at that time wherein we were not allowed to study Torah. We were not allowed to have the festivals. We were not allowed to have circumcision or wear tefillin. And now that the decree was lifted and the Jews were victorious, now we can resume all these activities. Question number three, it's in source number three, asked Rav Schwab Zatzal in Mayan Beit HaShoeva the following question. Ulefim pshuto mashma sha'an sha'at ha'yishua lo hayu oskim mitzvrim halalu. It would seem until this time they were not allowed to be involved in all these activities. V'kasheh, he says it's difficult. I understand, according to Rashi, we must say that this indeed was a reality, that there was this decree. But he says, ulefim pshuto, looking at it on the most simple level, reading the Megillah, we never find in the Purim story such a decree. Yes, Hanukkah we have that we were spiritually in peril, that we were not allowed to be able to celebrate the Yantif or have Milah, the circumcision, or learn Torah. That's the concept of the dreidel, the rouge. But Purim was a holiday wherein we're celebrating our physical salvation, not our spiritual salvation. So what does it mean that now the Jews were able to have Torah, now the Jews were able to have circumcision? It doesn't seem to make sense. And the final question before we begin for the morning is also a famous statement in the Megillah where it says in source number 4, Kimu v'kiblu ha-yehudim aleihem v'al-zaram v'al-kol nilvim aleihem v'lo yavur liyot osim et shnei hayamim ha-elu kichtavam v'kizmanam v'chol shana v'shana. The Jews confirmed and undertook themselves and their posterity, and upon all who might join them to observe these 2 days. And our rabbis note, and this is source 5b, the verse in the Megillah states, Kimu v'kiblu, they fulfilled and accepted. This wording seems to be somewhat strange, since normally acceptance must precede fulfillment. It almost reminds us of what? The Naseh v'nishma. We will do and then we will listen by Matan Torah, by the giving of the Torah. And in fact, in 5a, the Talmud tells us, when the Jews originally received the Torah, the verse says that they stood beneath the mountain, which comes to teach us that God held the mountain over them like a barrel, saying, if you accept the Torah, well and good, but if not, there will be your burial place. Rav Acha, the son of Yaakov, says, nevertheless, although they accepted the Torah under coercion at the time of the giving of the Torah, in the days of Achashverosh, the days of Purim, they re-accepted what they had accepted previously. Kimu ma shekiblu kfar. When it says they accepted, means they accepted what they had already accepted before at the time of the giving of the Torah, and now they're accepting it again. What does this mean? At the time of the Torah, we were coerced into accepting the Torah. And then for thousands of years or hundreds of years lapsed, and we're under this coercion, and finally in the times of Achashverosh, we re-accept the Torah in love. There was no other time before that that we turned to God and say, okay, we're now going to re-accept it in love. How do we understand this? So we have 5 questions. Question number 1 is, what's the message of the day? How can we inculcate this in our lives? Question number 2 is, what does it mean that Yom Kippur is like Purim and Purim is on a higher level than Yom Kippur? Question number 3, how do we understand the joy inherent in the day? It seems uncharacteristic of Jewish holidays. Question number 4, how do we understand the fact that only now the Jews are having the light of Torah, the joy of the festival, the circumcision? Till then, they didn't have this. And finally, question number 5, how do we understand only now they accepted the Torah out of love? What happened all these years, and what does it mean that they were coerced into accepting the Torah? For all these questions, we have one answer, one message for the morning. And I think it's a message that we can understand if we understand that the story of Purim is really a battle of Amalek. Haman, as we know, was a descendant of Amalek, the tribe which has this tremendous hatred for the Jews. And what I'd like to try to do together now is to look at the first time that Amalek appears in the Torah, the confrontation between the Jewish people and Amalek, and I think from this story we can glean what is the key between the relationship of the Jews and Amalek. when God sends a Molech to us to punish us. When we understand this, we'll understand the Purim story much deeper, and we'll thereby gain the lesson for our lives. Let's take a look at the story when the Jews meet a Molech for the first time. Source number 6, 17th chapter in the book of Shemot, where we have in verse number 8 at the bottom, a Molech arrived and attacked Israel there in Rephidim. So the Torah tells us that a Molech came and attacked us. Well, obviously something must have happened in order for a Molech to come. God just doesn't decide this is a nice morning to send a Molech down. Clearly not. What precipitated a Molech's coming? So that's the story that immediately precedes the story of a Molech coming. And let's begin, beginning of source number 6, where the entire Jewish community moved on from the Sin Desert, traveling according to God's instruction, until they camped in Rephidim, which our rabbis explained, Rafu Yadehem, their hands became weakened. Something happened in Rephidim. According to the textual level, what happened in Rephidim? There was no water for the people to drink. They began to quarrel with Moshe. Give us water to drink, they exclaimed. Why are you quarreling with me? Asked Moshe. Are you trying to test God? And Moshe named the place testing an argument because the people had argued and had tested God. The middle of the story I left out, God indeed says, take your staff, hit the rock, and water came from the rock. After they had the water, Moshe calls this place Massa Umariva. They'd argued and tested God. And this is the key line. They had asked, Hayesh Hashem bekirbenu im ayin. Is God with us or not? That seems a little bit funny here. They're asking for water. And suddenly, for this request for water, which seems to be a fine request, Moshe's saying, you're testing God, you're arguing with God, and it's a place where they're asking, is God with us or not? Ask Rav Wolbe in Ale Shur in source number 7 a very simple question. He says, we are not dealing with a simple generation here. We are dealing with the Dordea, the generation of knowledge, who had just crossed Yamsuf. They just crossed the Red Sea. They just received the man. I mean, to ask, is God among us or not? Well, let's wake up and smell the coffee. They just crossed the Red Sea. They just left Egypt. They just got the man, this heavenly food from heaven. Is God with us or not? What does this question mean? How can we ascribe such a question on the most simplistic level to a generation which saw God, which were actually, said Caleb, they were able to point to God and say, this is my God and I will glorify him. Make any sense? So explains Rav Wolbe and Ale Shur the following, and this is the key. He says, and this is in source number 8, when it says that they ask, is God with us or not? So Rav Wolbe explains, and I will not be able to explain this to you because my background of Kabbalah is zero. He explains that there are two aspects of apprehending God. There's an aspect of Yesh and an aspect of Ayin. Let's take a look inside. He says in source 8, Sheyesh Eitzel HaBarei Shtei Midok V'Hot Me'o. There are two very lofty aspects about God. Ha'el Yonah, the highest level, Nikreid Ayin, nothing. Why? Mipnei She'ein Livnei Adam Shum Hasagaba, Delayed Machshava Tfisa Beklal. It's a level of God in this world that we cannot apprehend intellectually. It's Ayin, it's above us, it's beyond us. It's the way God is involved in this world that we don't understand. And then, Hamidah Hashnia Hamistaefet Mimena Nikreid Yesh. There's a second corollary from that, which is the aspect of Yesh, there is, which is where we can apprehend God. What was their question? They were arguing about in what way does God treat us in the desert? Is it a level of Yesh or is it a level of Ayin? Hayesh Hashem v'yakribenim Ayin. Is there a Do we have the ability to understand God? Is it a Yesh ability? We have the Hasaga, we can't apprehend Him? Or is it Ayin? Is it beyond us and we can't understand God? Now, this intellectual and philosophical question, how is God relating to us as people, reflects the level of the Dordea, the generation of the desert, the generation of knowledge. But yet we find that Moshe is very critical of this discussion. And he calls it testing God. And the famous example that the Medrash brings and Rashi quotes is, and this is in the end of source number 9, is of a young child who's riding on the shoulders of his father. And the child says to his father, Abba, please give me this. And the father gives this to the child. Abba, can I have this? And the father gives this to the child. And then as they're walking along the way, the son meets a person and says, have you seen my father? At which point the father takes the child down, puts him on the ground, and a dog comes and bites the child. What do you mean, is your father around? Who's been giving you all this? This is the comparison that's used here. They're having this lofty understanding of God, and yet it's as if they're denying or challenging the fact that they're on God's shoulders or not. How can we compare the two? Clearly they know they're on God's shoulders. So this is it. And in fact, Rav Wolbe, when he gives this answer, says, Kore Yakar, my dear reader, stop for a moment and pause, because what I am telling you is very deep. And he offers the following understanding. He explains that as Jews, our mission in life is to walk with God. I'm in source 10. You have Et Elokim Hitalech Noach. Noach walked with God. By Abraham Hitalech Lefanai, walk in front of me. By the Jewish people were commanded Acharei Hashem Elokechem Teilechu, to walk after God. Source 10 on the bottom of the first sheet. You have to walk with God. And he says in the second paragraph in 10, Kimo b'chol hanagat Adam Yisrael, in every action of a Jew, kachu gam b'machshava, likewise in the thought process, yesh machshava hamitlave el habarei, there are thoughts and actions that bring you closer to God. And these are the thoughts and actions which are mitit shel Torah, the truth of Torah. And then he says, v'yesh machshava, third line, and this is the key, afilu b'torah, you can be thinking thoughts about God, about Torah, and the thoughts in of themselves are correct thoughts. They're not thoughts challenging God, but she'na meshet et habarei v'ki'ilu hadam b'machshavato hu livado. But if they're not going to bring you closer to God, then it's not considered walking with God. It is considered walking by yourself. Away and by yourself. And this, Rav Wolbe says, is the understanding of what happened in Masa Meriva. They had this intellectual discussion. In what aspect is God with us? Is he with us on the level of Yesha, we can apprehend him, or Ayin, where we can apprehend him? But the problem, Moshe Rabbeinu said, is you're testing God means the thought process, this intellectual exercise, is not something that's bringing you closer to God. There's nothing wrong in the thought process in of itself, but it has to lead you closer to God. You have to walk with God. And if you're not walking with God, you're walking away from him and you're walking levado by yourself. And that's why he says at the end of 10, this is what it means, as if they didn't realize they're on God's shoulders. You can be talking about God and yet not realize that you're on his very shoulders. Not realize your relationship with God. And that's why, if we move to the next page, source number 11, the place was called Rufidim. They were weakened. It was a weakness in their thought process. Because on the second line, 11, it was Begeder Halicha Levad. They were walking by themselves. And this is what poured on Amalek. because as we know, we'll be reading Shabbos Zohar, the Parshat Zohar, the Shabbos, Amalek is described as Asher Karcha Baderech, that has met you along the way, and our rabbis explain the word Karcha, has met you, with the Inyan of Kar, of coldness. Amalek represents coldness. When the Jewish people exhibited this idea of not walking with God, of walking by themselves, it's a relationship of coldness with God, and therefore God, in order to show this to the people, brings Amalek, which is a prototype of coldness, a prototype of not having a relationship with God, to attack the Jews, for them to realize this is your problem. And that's why the next story is Kabbalah Satorah, is accepting the Torah. Because in order to accept the Torah, one needs to know, as a prerequisite, you have to walk with God. You have to have a relationship with God. You can't walk by yourself. Now, the Shem Yishmuel, the Sukkot Shavuot Rebbe, explains in source number 13, slightly differently, what was it that they were weakened with? And he says, where it's underlined, Shelo hitchazku beregesh hanefesh ubechayut batara. They lack spirituality when studying the Torah. They lack the chayus, the life, the feeling. It's not only in thinking about God that you can reach a level of walking by yourself. It's even when you're involved in Torah and mitzvot itself. Sounds strange. One can be involved in a mitzvah. One can take a lulav and esrog. One can sit in a sukkah. One can celebrate Shabbos. And you're walking levado. You're walking by yourself. You're not walking with God. The mitzvahs are not bringing you closer to God. They are an alone experience. And we see this idea beautifully developed in the writings of Rav Dessler and Michtam Eliyahu in his Kuntres HaBechira, his famous treatise on free will, where he explains the concept of free will is like a battlefront, where the point of the battle itself is a fluid point. It's when you have two opposing forces within you that you have to overcome. But once you've overcome the battle, the line of the battle moves. Because that which I've overcome is no longer a struggle for me. It's no longer really a free choice, because I've already inculcated it into who I am. And therefore, a person who's raised their entire life from, or has taken upon themselves so many things that become second nature, that's really not free choice when I decide to do this. Now listen to what he says, because it's radical. Source 14. Most people who are brought up to a life of mitzvot and good deeds do these things without depth of feeling or commitment. Now, it is true that God does not deny the reward of any creature, and they'll certainly be rewarded for keeping to what they have learned. But if we're talking about elevated levels of mitzvah observance, they are almost completely absent. These levels are achieved only by bechira, by free choice, and these people really confront their evil inclination. And that's why in 15 it follows that the merits of a person are not those mitzvot and good deeds to which he has been trained, but only his free acts of bechira. Yes, you get rewarded, but that's not your real reward. The good acts he has been brought up to do are not his own. They merely serve to set the position of his bechira point. Whatever reward is due must go to those who brought him up so well. They fulfill the mitzvah of education by ensuring that his first bechira act should take place at a high level. And listen to the example that he gives. It's wild. It's the story of Lot. He quotes it from Nuss and Tzvi, Finkel of Slobodka. Let's take a look at 16. He writes that Avram's characteristic was loving kindness, so much so that anyone who lived with him adapted this mode of behavior to the utmost degree. And we see this from Lot, moving to the underlying section, who was brought up in Avram's household and had learned the ways of loving kindness to such a degree that when he came across strangers in Sodom, he was ready to insist that they come to his house. And in the moment of danger, he risked his life to protect them from the mob, which threatened to break down the door. What a level of chesed, a level of kindness. Now, yet 17, when the Torah tells us by what merit Lot deserved to be saved from Sodom, says that God remember Abraham and saved Lot from the destruction. What did God remember? What was the schut? What was the merit that Lot had? So Rashi notes that Lot knew that Sarah was Abraham's wife, and he heard Abraham referring to Sarah as his sister, and he did not reveal the secret. When they were in Egypt, he didn't go around telling people, they're not brother and sister, the husband and wife. Hold on a second. That's the merit he had for not telling on Lot and Sarah were sisters and his brother-in-law? We would have thought that what was the merit? His chesed, his kindness. I mean, who would even think he would tell on Avram and Sarah? Wouldn't even enter our minds, but yet that is considered the great merit that he had. Makes no sense. He did something much greater. They're about to break down his door. He saved his guest. And this is the key in 18. From this you can learn that any behavior a person adapts as a result of training or by copying others is not counted as his own and does not stand to his credit on the day of judgment. Wow. What does? Only that which is truly his own. The fact that he conquered his evil inclination in a matter on his own level. Something he had not been trained in. Something that was not his own particular bechira. And he notes, it should be remembered, that Lot's weak point was greed. It was because of his greed that he left Abraham. And it was his greed that led him to Sodom in the first place. His natural aversion to betraying his uncle was balanced by the thought of the riches that would be his had he been the sole relative of the much-praised Sarah. And the conditions of a true Bechira were fulfilled. He overcame that struggle, and in that merit, he was saved. And that's why he concludes in 19 that happy is the man who uses all that has been given him by his upbringing as a springboard, and whose ambition is to rise to ever more elevated levels in deed and devotion. Because the greatest aim of all is to pursue a life of Torah and mitzvot while ensuring that one's good deeds are done by Bechira. It involves confronting the Yetzer Hara at every step. And there'll be plenty of confrontation because the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, opposes anything that is determined to elevate a person. So if we pause for one moment and try to understand what Rav Dessler is saying on a practical level, a person who is raised in a Shabbat observing home and keep Shabbos automatically is a person who potentially could be walking, as we saw in the Alei Shur, Levado by himself. It's not bringing him to a level of divine consciousness, a level of Dveikut. There's no struggle. You know when Lich comes, when candlelight comes, you light the candles, and now you go into what's called Shabbos motion. The candles are lit, the table's set, Kiddush is made, the Hamotzi's made, you eat the meal, you sing the song. You do everything you're supposed to do. But not once have you come closer to God. The credit comes when you're on a level of Bechira of free choice, where you have to struggle. Which would be, for example, if Divrei Torah, words of Torah, are not spoken at the table, people just can't sit through them, speak words of Torah. Elevate the meal. If words of Torah are spoken, are they spoken appropriately for the children at the table? If they are spoken appropriately for the children at the table, is a book learned together at the table? The laws of chesed, the laws of kindness, the laws of Shabbat. Everyone has a different level of bechira. But it's that struggle. It's difficult. The kids can't sit through it. It's hard to find a book we all like. That's it. That's exactly it. That's the struggle. That's the reward. And that's coming closer to God. And that's making the Shabbos experience not by rote. It's not a levado experience. It's coming closer to God. It's elevating the experience. So I think that what we've seen from the first story of Amalek and the Jewish people is that there was some level of kriros, some level of coldness, the levado of walking by ourselves, of not realizing we're on God's shoulders, that brought Amalek down and says that we are an outer manifestation of what you're feeling inside. And when Amalek comes again in the Purim story, it's the exact same problem. This is source number 20. It's based on a Gemara and Megillah. In his speech to Achashverosh, Haman described the Jews with the phrase Yeshno Amachad. It's composed of the same letters as Yashnu, they slept. Yashnu min ha-mitzvot, it's the language of the Gemara. They were sleeping with their commandments. What does this mean? Thus Haman was hinting to the king that Israel were in a solemn state spiritually, and there would therefore be a propitious time to destroy them. Haman achieved his momentary terrifying hold over Israel simply because. This is the key. Look at ourselves. Look at the story. Although they observed all the commandments punctiliously, the Jews lacked exuberance in their actions. Their performance was merely mechanical, robot-like. And this, says Rav Schwab, is the answer to our fourth question. Source number 21. What does it mean when it says, La Yehudim Haita Oru V'Simcha V'Sasson V'Yikar, that Oru is Torah and Sasson is Yontif, if they didn't have it before? Rav Schwab says the following, and I don't think it's by accident that we say this statement out loud every Saturday night. It's the key. It's the key to this shiur. It's the key of Purim. It's the key of life. Says Rav Schwab the following. 21. V'yesh l'faresh, we need to understand, Sharei b'vadai hayu lahem tarav yomtov umilav tzvilin. They had it. There was no decree against them. Rather, what? Gam l'snei Yeshua, even before the salvation. This is it. Aval haita hatara b'li ora. V'gam haya yomtov b'li simcha. They had Torah. What was lacking? The ora, the light. They had Yontif. What was lacking? The feeling. The joy. That's what was lacking. It was a body without a spirit. A guf b'li neshama. That is what was missing in a time of Purim. Yes, one can do everything, but be walking levado by oneself and not realize you're on God's shoulders. And that's why we find in sources 22, 23, and 24 that when Mordechai found out about what happened, he started screaming through the city and put sackcloth on. And when Esther heard about this, she immediately sent clothes and said, don't make this public demonstration. Quiet. Which is Esther's personality of Hester, of quietness, of inwardness, of modesty. To which Mordechai responded, Esther, you don't understand. Who are we dealing with here? We're dealing with Haman. We're dealing with the element of coldness. Where we're not awake. Where we're sleeping. We need to wake up the Jewish people because this is the very problem. We need to scream out in the city streets. We need to wear sackcloth in the city square. We need to raise the people to a level of consciousness and awareness of doing tshuva, of walking with God. Because that's what's missing. And in this respect, Mordechai was very successful. Mordechai was able to raise the people to a level of divine consciousness, to a level of divine awareness, to a level of Megillat Esther. Megillah Legalot means to reveal, Esther, that which is hidden. That's the level he brought to people, where the people were able to understand that all the seemingly coincidences that were found in the story are all the hand of God. And to find God within the story. And to find God, whose name is not mentioned in the story, to find him. To search him out. To walk with God. And this, Rabbi Tatz mentions in World Mask, we see in the name nature itself. 28, the Hebrew word for nature is teva, the root of which means to drown. If the world of natural cause and effect is not carefully and perceptibly studied for its clues to depth, it drowns awareness of the spiritual. But the word teva is also the root of matbea, meaning a coin which has an embossed image stamped on its surface. The world is a stamped out image of a higher reality. If one studies the world with the knowledge that it accurately reflects its source, one can perceive the features of that source surely and consistently. The choice is entirely the observer's. One can look at the world with the tired eyes of habit and see only the mechanical, only that which drowns the spirit, or one can look with the eyes of wonder and see the image of a higher reality. And that's the Purim story. The Purim story is a story of seeing God in a hidden way, of being able to look at different events that occurred throughout the story, which is familiar to all of us, that's why I'm not spending time on it, and to be able to say, this is the hand of God. We see God here. We're looking for God here. We're looking for that relationship. And this is the difference, as Sifti Chaim points out, between the original acceptance of the Torah and the acceptance of the Torah now. The Sifti Chaim points out the famous statement of the Maharal of Prague. What does it mean that the Jewish people were coerced into accepting the Torah? The coercion was that at Mount Sinai, God appeared to them with his full glory. You had but no option but to accept the Torah. There was no option. You saw God. You felt God. When it means that God put the mountain over their head, it means that God revealed himself in such a manner that clearly you saw God. And throughout the next years and periods in history, God revealed himself in that manner, in an open manner. There was no option. Comes along our first exile. Comes along the Purim story. God is no longer revealed. We are no longer passive. We see God. We have no choice. The beauty and the message of the Purim story is search out for God. He's hidden. Does one realize the miracles that happen in one's life? And when one comes to this realization and understanding from oneself, it's a level of love with God. It's a level of appreciation with God. It's almost like, to bring this down onto a practical level, any relationship between two people that are close to one another, a spouse, a good friend, most of life we take that person for granted. And when they do something really out of the ordinary, for some it might be taking out the garbage, but depends. When they do something out of the ordinary, I don't mean that. We feel tremendous gratitude for them. The challenge is, when it's the day-to-day living, that we appreciate what they do. And that the love grows from the relationship of every single day. And we deal one with another every day. And now we can clearly understand the difference between Yom Kippur and Purim. Yom Kippur is a day of awe. It's a day where we look at God from afar. It's the Yirat HaRomamut, the exaltedness of God. There's a certain distance, a certain fear. Purim is a time of coming closer to God from a totally different vantage point. It's God, I see you in my life. I'm connected to you. I see the miracles that you perform for me b'chol yom, every day. And I want this connection. I want this love. And that's what sparked on Purim. Seeing the miracle sparked that relationship. And that relationship is even on a higher level. Source 32, Purim surpasses even Yom Kippur, because Yom Kippur purifies us from our sins through the purging effects of fear, of awe and divine judgment. An even stronger effect is produced by the buildup of joy, gratitude, and love, which is the hallmark of Purim. And now we can also understand the nature of Purim. 33. With all that has been clarified, we may now grasp the positive effects of the excitement that forms an integral part of the Purim celebration. It is essential, however, that these feelings be translated into our spiritual lives. In this way, we'll be simulating the rectification that was carried out by Mordechai so many years ago in Shushan. And once we are infected with a proper enthusiasm in our fulfillment of the Torah, it will lead us to another acceptance of the Torah as occurred in the times of the Megillah. Do you know why we have this outer joy on Purim? Because the outer joy is a reflection of the love we feel for God. But the whole problem of Purim was a problem of krirus, a problem of coldness, a problem of lack of enthusiasm. So the way we counteract that lack of enthusiasm, the lack of appreciation for God, is to go to the other extent, to break down our inhibitions and to express our love, to express our joy, to go all out with joy, with love, with celebration. But, and this is the key, and this is the difficult part, it can't end there. The outer joy, the outer exuberance must affect us inwardly, spiritually. That when I feel this outer joy and I feel this enthusiasm, the question then is, how can I bring it into me? That my relationship with God will be that of enthusiasm. Not only on Purim, every day, that I'll be walking not with Vado by myself, but I'll be walking with God. That's the challenge. So the outer joy of Purim is supposed to spark within me the inner joy, that inner relationship with God. That's very nice. But there's something called reality. And reality is, I'll speak for myself, not for anyone here. Reality is, it often doesn't do that. We have the joy of Purim, and I understand intellectually that now that means I must bring it inside me. But the next day, Shushan Purim, and for sure by 2 days afterwards, we're back to our normal routine. The lack of exuberance, the lack of enthusiasm. So what I'd like to try to do in the next couple of moments is to now answer the second part of our first question. The message of Purim is the message called wake up. Have a relationship of love, a relationship of enthusiasm with God. Find God in one's life. Feel God. Realize we're on God's shoulders. How do we do this? So, the Maharal, on that verse, La'yehudim haita oru v'simcha, Sussan V'Ikar, 34 notes, that these refer to different aspects of our devotion to God. The light of Torah refers to the intellectual aspect. The joy of the festival refers to the emotional aspect. While gladness of circumcision indicates the physical, the intellectual, emotional, and physical comprise the three basic aspects of the human personality. And the glory of tefillin comprises them all, says the Maharal. We mentioned earlier that the miracle of Purim brought Israel to a state of intense gratitude. This, in turn, induced in them love for and devotion to the Almighty in many ways. And the four aspects of devotion referred to above are the four modes in which this devotion may be expressed. And let's, for a number of moments, try to examine each one, because I think they have a practical effect on our lives. The Michtam Eliyahu, in source number 35, in Chelek Dalet, writes a letter to his students. When asked, Ech mevatlim et pulat hahergel, how do we break out of the routine, the habit? And he says, with the asterisks in 35, Omnam ha'iyun ve'itbonenut heima asher yivatlu et pulat hahergel. Because kol davar asher yayein bo hadam nimsam bo chidush. You want to know how to change our mitzvot that we do not fall into that state? Understand what we do. Investigate intellectually what the mitzvah means. Half the time we do mitzvahs, we don't understand their meaning. We don't understand what they're all about. So that's why they have no impact on my life. If I understand what the lulav and etrog really mean, oh, I'd be like those rebbes that are so excited to do the mitzvah, they wake up early, and they smash their hand through the glass where the etrog is kept, because of their excitement to do the mitzvah. They don't even realize the door of the cabinet is closed. We don't have the understanding. Le'ehudim hayta'orah, orazu Torah. This is the intellectual aspect. Understand what Torah mitzvot are all about. If we have an understanding, it leads to an awareness, it leads to newness. Point two. That the joy of festival refers to the emotional aspect. And here in 36 and 37, Rav Dessler in another essay says that just to learn in order to know is not sufficient. It has to be, third line in 36, it has to affect the person. It has to be hashava el halev. It has to be inculcated within the person themselves. You have to make it part of you. It just cannot remain on the intellectual sphere. And I'd like to just pause for one moment and note that I cannot stress this aspect enough. Teaching in high school, I find that this is probably the most prevalent problem in keeping Torah mitzvot today. You ask the students, what are the laws of Shabbos? Oh, they know them better than I do. You ask them, do you feel Shabbos? Is it part of you? It's very often a levado experience, walking alone experience. And Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal in Source 38 in Drash Moshe mentioned this. He says that when we keep Torah and mitzvot, it has to be something that our children and our students will want to keep. It will be something that's hashava el alev, brought into oneself to be emotionally connected with God. It's not easy. I know with my 3-month-old, a little bit young, but it's never too young to start, and Rav Moshe mentions this as well. We have, thank God, guests all the time. So I always say to her, I say, Rachel, we have mitzvah achnas orachim, and how lucky we are to have guests, and what a special opportunities we have guests. And I knew that I was getting somewhere when one of my Yule students, who was over for Shabbos, turned to me at the end of Shabbat and said, I think the first word that Rachel will say is not Abba and Ima, but orachim, but guests. It has to be an enthusiasm, a light, that we're connected in that way. They have to speak to us. The third aspect, it's probably a more metaphysical aspect, 39, the gladness of circumcision, the knowledge that our very bodies are consecrated to God, creates a very special relationship between ourselves and our Creator. And here, Rabbi Rucham Levavitz Zatzal, Mashkiach of Mir, points out that we have to reach a level, he explains in depth, which we'll not touch on right now, that the guf itself has to reach a level of neshama, of soul. And he says that's the essence of Purim, that I'll leave for one's own reading. But if we turn to Source 41, the last page, of the very first man, Adam, we are told that the very heel of his foot was radiant with a light that outshone the light of the sun. Adam was so caught up in the radiance and in the closeness to God that even his physical nature, down to the heel of his foot, was imbued with this love and worship, greater than the force of all the material world. Even to the very sun that seems to animate, and sustain it. Such a perfect unity existed between his body and his soul, a harmony of desire and intent, that it was though the body itself were a spiritual thing. That the body is not in conflict with the soul, that the body is not only gaining physical pleasure from eating, but rather spiritual pleasure as well. And finally, 42, the Gloria Tefillin. Everyone wants to emphasize her own importance. Rav Dessler continues, we all want to feel that there's something which we excel. This is one of the strongest drives in the human psyche. If a person reaches a level at which the point in which he wishes to excel is his service of God, then he has given his soul self to God. This is the commitment. This is walking with God, not walking by oneself. Okay, sounds very easy. How do we bring the Purim message of having exuberance and some hislavos, some life to our mitzvot? We don't have the kriwas, the coldness of Amalek. Very easy. intellectually we should analyze what we do to understand it, emotionally bring it back to ourselves, try to have our physical selves also reach a spiritual level, bring our whole selves closer to God. Great. That's a very tall task. Also, not so easy to do. So we have another suggestion. This is a suggestion found in sources 43, 44, 45, and 46. And it's based on an amazing understanding of Rabbi Rucham Zatzal. He says the following in Daf Chochma Musar. He says that the verse from which we learn that the Jewish people accepted the Torah with love and they found God is the verse of Kimu v'Kiblo Yehudim, they accepted and reaffirmed. But he says if you look at the verse, and the verse is quoted on the first page in source number 4, the verse on its simplistic level has nothing to do with the concept of accepting Torah. The verse is speaking about accepting the mitzvah of Purim. And he says this is the key. Let's read Rabbi Rucham together. He says, Ulechora at first glance, Heichan hayasham kabbalat ha-Torah b'raton. Where do we find the acceptance of the Torah with will? Halo ein muskar sham rak mitzvah megillah. If you look at the verse, it only speaks about the mitzvah megillah. When we say where the asterisk is, Mifarer lanu, source 43, Shemiratzon kol dehu, having a desire, Mimitzvah achat, from doing one mitzvah, Shaita b'raton, that they did willingly, Mitapechet kol ha-Torah kula ma'onus l'ratzon. What do you need? One mitzvah. Where do you start? You start by focusing in on one mitzvah and taking the four elements that we mentioned and investing them in that one mitzvah, intellectually understanding that mitzvah, emotionally being connected to that mitzvah. And this, Rabbi Miller in Shabbat Shirin notes, he says, with the asterisk in the 45, in practical terms, this means that each individual can find for himself some mitzvah to which he feels especially attracted, for which holds for him a particular beauty. On this mitzvah, he can lavish all his thought and devotion, giving it his whole strength and gleaning from it immeasurably more than he gained. And moving up one paragraph, by fully realizing this special consciousness, man can fill himself with the awareness of God, radiating outwards. If at least we do one mitzvah walking with God and not by ourselves, the one mitzvah where we're going to have, as Rav Dessler explained, that struggle, and we're going to work on intellectually growing with it and emotionally growing from it and physically growing from it and making that our commitment to God, that's going to have the effect on who we are and our relationship with God. We'll feel God. My final point. This too is very difficult. This too needs time to work on. So what do we do until we find this mitzvah? My last suggestion for the morning. Beyond this, I can't break it down anymore. And that again, if we look closely, is what Rabbi Rucham was saying. Last line. Second to last line. Shebezehu sod hatzlachato v'aliyato. You know how you'll be successful? Shiratzon hachi kal. The simplest desire. Mishaneh changes ve'oseh mikol hatara u'mitzvot shelo yu ba'ones ela baratzon. It begins with a desire. It begins with a desire to change. It begins with a desire to grow. If we have that desire to come closer to God, then that desire will bring a person to finding that mitzvah. And within that mitzvah, investing it intellectually, emotionally, and physically. And from that one mitzvah, then one can appreciate the whole spectrum of mitzvahs and one's relationship with God. But it has to begin with a ratzon. It has to begin with a desire. And that's what Purim does. Purim, the outer festivities and the outer joy, is to awaken within us this one nekuda, this one point called ratzon, desire. And once we have this desire of not walking by ourselves and not doing things out of rote, out of habit, but wanting to come closer to God, feeling God's presence, then everything else will follow suit. Let me just review all the questions, and then I'll take questions. Our first question was, what's the message of Purim and how we can bring it into our lives? The message of Purim is clearly not doing mitzvot out of rote, but to wake up and feel that closeness to God, and we do it ultimately with the ratzon, with desire. And that's why we can understand why Purim is on a higher level than Yom Kippur, because Purim is a time of ratzon, it's a time of desire, it's a time of love where we come closer to God. And this as well understands the festivities, because the festivities help us bring out that ratzon, bring out that desire. We don't find anywhere that there were these decrees. That's correct. There were perhaps no decrees, but rather, once again, they lacked ratzon, they lacked desire. It was Torah without light. And the key move, the key blow, HaYehudim, the acceptance was an acceptance from their own volition of finding God. And once again, the key in finding God within the story of Purim, within the hiddenness of God, within the hiddenness of our lives, to see it as a matbea, as a coin, rather than tovea, to drown, is again that one item, is ratzon, is desire. If we have that desire, so the joy of Purim is going to bring within in us, it's going to ignite within us that desire, and from that desire, our closeness to God will just increase. Questions? It's an excellent question. I think what Rabbi Miller is saying is to find something that you feel connected with. Not something that you're going to struggle with. Something that speaks to you. You love to eat. Pick blessings. Because you do it all day. Find something. Shabbos just speaks to you. So find a mitzvah element on Shabbos. Shabbos is too broad. Find something on Shabbos. Lighting candles. Whatever it is that's going to speak to you. Pick something that already your heart is moving toward that area and develop that area. That's much easier. Excellent question. Any other questions? So one understands that when one sets out into the process, that the goal of this process is closeness to God. That's where I'm headed. And everything I'm going to do is going to be, in the words of Alei Shur, Olivyat Chaim. It's going to accompany God. And that has to be my model. Because it's so easy in life to do things and quote unquote do things religiously and yet not connect with God. Yes, yes. Learning from the intellectual experience is a perfect example. All right, it's an excellent question. And this will be the last question because the hour is a little bit late. Is the desire an inborn desire or not? And the answer, Rabbi Miller also speaks about in another essay, Shabbat Shirim, the answer is emphatically, it is born within you. And he quotes as the model for this, the fact that when one is in utero, one is taught the whole Torah. One has that closeness to God. It just gets buried as we grow up and as we have the material world block us from that closeness to God. What we need to do is to shed that and come back to the original ratzon, the original will.